Well, the US president has worn many labels, most of them from his critics, and some of them are very serious, dangerous, deranged. But he's often called, at least on placards, but increasingly in books, a fascist. So does that label really hold up? Are there comparisons between America today and the interwar years of Europe and the rise of these authoritarian dictators like Mussolini and then, of course, Hitler? Christopher Browning has studied and written books on the Holocaust and Nazi Germany. He's the Emeritus Professor of History at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And he has a new essay in the latest edition of the New York Review of Books. It's called The Suffocation of Democracy. And he tries to deal with this question. And Christopher Browning joins me now on Saturday Extra.
Thank you very much.
It is a term, fascist, that's thrown around often pretty carelessly. Just briefly define for us in historical terms, what is a fascist and what kind of world are they trying to create?
Well, the term, of course, originated with the political party that Benito Mussolini founded in the 1920s in Italy, and then a series of other parties that were similar in their style and goals, then, of course, took that on as a generic name. So it is both a specific name for one party, the Italian Fascist Party, and a generic term for all those that followed in its wake. They do, of course, generally have common features of being anti-democratic, authoritarian, all power to the leader, nationalist, expansionary, and aggressive. Not all of them, but most of them racist as well as aggressive. Anti-socialist, anti-liberal, anti-democratic, anti-communist, a lot of antis in there, and that sort of covered the middle to the left of the political spectrum in Europe at that time. Most of them allied uneasily with the conservatives of a more traditional sort when it suited their purposes, but dispensed with that alliance when they no longer needed it. So we do place them on the right end of the political spectrum, though they were both reactionary and revolutionary in terms of remaking society that separated them from traditional conservatives.
So is it fair or accurate then to characterize Trump, even though he has, let us say, authoritarian displays of emotion or, you know, rhetoric, but is it accurate to call him a fascist?
I would hesitate using that term for Trump because I think it distracts more than it helps us to understand him. With Trump and with what we are seeing with many others of his ilk today, I don't think fits sufficiently into the fascist model of the 30s to fully illuminate where the threat is coming from. That is, all of those movements were profoundly and overtly anti-democratic. They suspended legislatures. They set up police states. Certainly both Italy and Mussolini, or and Hitler, the right to arrest their opponents, hold them without trial, severe censorship of the press, an end of free press. And what we're seeing today is what I would call not so much fascism, but as the threat of illiberalism or the threat of a new authoritarianism, which is much more subtle. Basically, they've learned you don't have to ban all the other political parties. You just have to learn how to rig elections. You don't have to censor and stop all the free press. You simply have to learn how to pollute the pool of information with false news and manipulation to the extent that even if information is printed in the free press, nobody can make sense out of what's right and what isn't because there are so many false stories out there circulating, and it's almost impossible to sort things out, particularly if your predisposition is to support the leader. You take his word. You don't try to go out and sort your way through all sorts of conflicting accounts to make up your own mind. So we don't have a banning of political parties. We don't have a banning of the free press. We don't have a police state. But we do have regimes all around the world that are tending to keep the fig leaf of multi-party democratic pretense. Elections are still held, but the reality that is being hollowed out because the free press doesn't operate as a guardrail anymore, and political parties don't, in fact, represent a real alternative when you go to vote. I think that's where the real threat comes from, and that's why I don't like to use the word fascist, because we're looking for things that aren't the real danger. We're looking for imitations of Hitler and Mussolini when we must be looking at where the current danger comes from.
Well, Christopher, you do raise, though, the very similar conditions that led to fascism in the 30s, and especially when it comes to economic crisis and a lack of confidence and a growing inequality. Now, of course, America in the 1930s turned to the great social democrat, Franklin Roosevelt. But are there economic similarities now that have enabled Donald Trump's rise?
I mean, what we're in now is kind of the post-industrial crisis. That is, how to adjust to a new economy in the developed areas of the world where manufacturing factories are no longer at the heart of the economy. Automation, obsolescence, to some degree outsourcing, though that is, of course, vastly exaggerated as a cause of losing jobs because it's a nice xenophobic scapegoating explanation for what has happened, basically mean that a way of life for a fair number of the population has lost its viability. And we have not yet really found the substitute. The new computer economy, the knowledge economy, does not accommodate these people at anything like the same level of income. So they suffer an extreme drop in status and in income, which made them, at least in the United States, very vulnerable to the populist appeal of Trump, who could blame this on free trade, could blame it on outsourcing, even though the problem is partly that, but much more complex ultimately than that.
On Saturday Extra, I'm speaking with historian Christopher Browning, and we're discussing Christopher's essay in the latest edition of the New York Review of Books, The Suffocation of Democracy, and it looks specifically at Donald Trump at a very apposite time. I want to focus on some very specific things, though, very specific similarities that you look at. For example, isolation in foreign policy and restrictive immigration policies. I can certainly see the immigration comparisons, but in the 1930s, weren't fascists empire builders? And Donald Trump really wants to withdraw from the world, doesn't he?
Yes, this is a major difference that Donald Trump has now called himself a nationalist, and he is much more in terms of the immigration issue. He is not that, at least in comparison to self-styled 1930s nationalists, for whom nationalism meant expansion of the nation, meant conquest and expansion over your enemies. I mean, one of the arguments that is offered here by those who still support Trump is that despite his peculiarities in terms of his tweeting, his insulting people, his style, they still say basically he's delivering to them lower taxes, conservative judges, deregulation of the economy, and trying to keep the foreigners out. And they say this is all very good, so we like the substance even if we don't like the style. What I tried to argue in that article is that America has done this before in the sense of the 1920s. We had a regime that believed in isolationism, like Trump, that believed in tariffs, like Trump, that believed in the utterly racially determined immigration policy. You wanted to let in only certain types of people who would enhance or preserve the dominance of a white portion of the population. At that time, the aliens were Catholics and Jews, and you wanted to preserve a white Protestant domination. Now it is, of course, whites of every religion, but let's not let in brown and black people. And, of course, an economy then that was experiencing extraordinary disparity in income. This spread in income going up to 1929 was very much like what we're experiencing today. And my argument is it didn't work out then. So let us not call that the good side of Trump. The upshot of that after 1929 was very disastrous. And that is not the path that we should be following. So the problem with Trump is not just his bad manners, but the fact that his policies have led to bankruptcy in the States once before. Let's not repeat that once again.
There are other eerie similarities, though, because you mention the process of judicial appointments and also making hay, as it were, out of political instability, the dysfunctional system in the various parliaments. Now, when there was a divided Congress, Obama in the White House, the Republicans on Capitol Hill, absolute dysfunction. Are there similarities then between what happened in the 30s?
Yes, from 1930 to 1933, certainly Weimar democracy in Germany had reached a virtual gridlock. And in fact, you had no governing majority, so that the president, Hindenburg, ruled by emergency decree, which the Constitution allowed, appointing chancellors, and chancellors would issue laws as long as there was no negative majority to rescind or veto those laws. And so Germany was at a point where it was already no longer being ruled by a majority. And of course, one could argue today that Trump was elected by a minority. He had nearly 3 million fewer votes than Hillary Clinton. The gerrymandering in Congress, in the House, gives the Republicans much more representation than their proportion of the vote would reward to them if you had a system of voting that awarded equal power of the ballot without redesigning boundaries to basically ensure that many candidates are running in districts where they can't lose. And the opposition votes are all clustered together in a few districts where they're all wasted because they get many more votes to get a majority than they need. So one can say that in the U.S. has reached a point in terms of voter repression, of gerrymandering, where increasingly, though not yet totally, the electoral system is becoming less and less responsive. If the Democrats can win the House of Representatives this fall, it's going to take a majority, not of 1%, but something probably between 7 and 11% over what the Republicans get just to get a bare majority. And that means that you're reaching the limit by which the voting public will have any check or can hold their government accountable. It will require, in a sense, a landslide victory to win a narrow majority in the House. And that is that we're stretching the point at which there is any functioning Democratic election in that regard.
Just finally, Christopher, many years ago, at the height of George W. Bush's presidency, or arguably at its depth because he was in a great deal of trouble, a scholar at a Washington think tank told me that before America had a new progressive era, it would have to go through a searing right-wing period of politics, and don't think that George W. Bush is it. There is something harder to come. Is Donald Trump the curtain raiser to a new progressive era on politics as part of a backlash?
In American politics, a certain kind of pendulum. And so you went from Bush to Obama and then back to Trump. And of course, that is a swing in one direction much further than Obama had been to the left, who was a fairly moderate, somewhat left-center kind of figure. The notion that we can just wait it out and that the fever will break and then everything will straighten itself out is a hope that I think we have to be very careful about. That the problems that have emerged are not going to be easily solved even with a small or narrow Democratic victory. How to reverse the growing disparity in income, how to deal with global warming, which is so rapidly approaching the tipping point of no return, how to repair a society that's become as divided as ours is, both in terms of race and class and geographically. These are not things that are going to be easily papered over once the fever breaks and Trump is gone, whenever and however that is. My fear is that we have more than simply a swing of the pendulum here, that we are in fact at a point where there's some very, very serious issues that it is going to be very difficult to deal with even after Trump is gone.
Good to talk to you, Christopher Browning, Professor of History Emeritus at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's now on the West Coast of America, and we'll post a link to Christopher's latest New York Review of Books essay called The Suffocation of Democracy at the Saturday Extra homepage. Thanks so much for joining us on the program, Christopher.
Thank you so much for inviting me.